This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. Some residents of Carteret County are up in arms about a proposed fumigation facility key to a lumber export business at the port in Morehead City. Actual fumigation operations would be conducted by a private entity working under contract as a tenant at the port. Spokesman Tom Mather says the Division of Air Quality decided to announce a public hearing due to an overwhelming response from concerned citizens.
The last count I got, we had received about 500 emails.
The uproar is due to Delaware-based company Royal Fumigation's application for a permit to begin fumigation operations in an existing facility.
We do not hold public hearings on all air quality permits. We've got close to 3,000 permitted facilities around the state. And so we generally hold public hearings if we get a lot of requests for one and we've determined that there is public interest involved.
So far, the public hearing has been scheduled, but no date, location, or time has been announced. At the center of the controversy is the use of methyl bromide, a chemical deemed hazardous by the Environmental Protection Agency.
Basically, what they want to do is treat logs before they are exported with methyl bromide, which is a gas that's primarily used as a pesticide. And they're doing that because some countries will not accept materials like plant material unless it's been treated, because it might bring in insects and other diseases.
Methyl bromide was once widely used in eastern North Carolina to fumigate tobacco and other crops. It's also highly effective at eliminating pests. But when the chemical was found to be a significant ozone-depleting substance, organizations like the EPA began to warn of its potential danger. The concentration that would be used at the Morehead City port is what has residents concerned most. Royal Fumigation's cover letter accompanying the permit application stated the facility would emit up to 140 tons per year of methyl bromide. That's 14 times the amount currently permitted by the Federal Clean Air Act.
Right now, the permit requests submitted by the consulting company called for the release of the toxic gas into the air after it's done its job. There are other techniques.
Chairman of the grassroots organization Clean County Coalition, Dick Beerley, says they've sent a letter to Governor Pat McCrory, the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and other state officials, urging them to consider other alternatives.
If, in fact, we're only a year away from a total ban of the use of the gas, there must be some alternatives that are being considered. Why doesn't the port go after those?
According to the EPA's website, both chemical and non-chemical alternatives to methyl bromide exist, and state law requires the Division of Air Quality to research other alternatives. Division of Air Quality spokesman Tom Mather.
That's going to be part of our evaluation when we look at this permit.
The highest exposure of methyl bromide will be to workers at the facility, but Division of Air Quality officials will also look into the potential impact on residential areas and businesses surrounding the port. According to the EPA's website, human exposure to high concentrations of methyl bromide can result in central nervous system and respiratory system failure, as well as specific and severe harmful actions on the lungs, eyes, and skin. In a written statement from the Senior Director of External Affairs for the North Carolina State Ports Authority, Laura Blair, Royal fumigation work will proceed at the Port of Morehead City if and only if regulatory agencies are satisfied that fumigation activities can be carried out in an environmentally safe manner. The authority has made no final decision on this potential business at the Port of Morehead City and won't until the appropriate regulatory agencies have closely examined the operation and the potential environmental impacts. Royal Fumigation already performs fumigations at ports and other warehouse locations from New York down into Georgia along the East Coast. We reached out to the company earlier this week, but they declined our request for interview. In a written statement to Public Radio East, they said operations at the port would be conducted under the direct supervision of officials from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, Plant Protection and Quarantine Division. Even with the government oversight, Clean County Coalition Chairman Dick Beerley is opposed to the fumigation facility.
The port is grasping at straws. They're not consistently profitable. They don't look at the big picture when they consider options, and year after year they come up with ideas that are not compatible with the fact that we're a vacation, tourism, natural resource center now. But they do it because they're up against it from a business and finance point of view.
Some believe the benefits outweigh any perceived risks. City manager for the town of Morehead City, David Whitlow, sees economic potential from the fumigation facility.
In this particular case, loggers would be affected by it. Trucker operations would be bringing product in. The people who would be on the port itself handling the product. The people who have the tree farms would be raising the timber that would be utilized for these logs. So you have pretty wide potential for economic impact.
It's too early in the process to estimate specifically what the economic impact could be. Whitlow says the city has not yet decided if they're for or against the proposed fumigation facility.
We're still in the information collecting phase, wanting to know what's involved, how often they plan to do this, getting more particulars about any release of this to the atmosphere, looking at how it gets dissipated in the atmosphere, try and get more information about the chemistry and kind of letting the process run its course in order for us to get the information to take an official position.
The Division of Air Quality plans to release a draft air quality permit before the public meeting is set, and spokesman Tom Mather says that's probably still several months away. Meanwhile, he says they'll be researching how other states implement fumigation facilities. If an air quality permit is issued, Royal Fumigations will be subjected to unannounced periodic inspections, and Division of Air Quality officials will respond to complaints. Opposition to the fumigation facility is already making its presence known online. A petition seeking to acquire more than 2,000 signatures is already past its halfway mark. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. What started off in 2010 with a few local kids and a tripod-mounted camera has developed into a full-blown production studio for young film enthusiasts. Lee Jenkins has more.
Carteret County's Teen Film Club now has 24 regular members from Havelock to Beaufort, aged anywhere between 12 and 19. So far, the club has produced a small TV show and a 6-episode miniseries called The Persistence of Time. As the name would imply, the miniseries deals with time travel, explains club founder Melissa Bennett.
It was about a brother and sister who live in the future. They end up taking a time machine back to Victorian England. And in the process, their time machine breaks down and they're stuck in Victorian England. They run into all these problems as they try and fix the time machine, and they have to sort of overcome all these obstacles.
According to Bennett, the club didn't start filming until late winter, though members had been working on it as early as the fall of 2012.
They started writing it as soon as the first Saturday after Labor Day. We did a lot of pre-production work from September to January, trying to raise money, making costumes, making sets, writing. And then from February till about mid-May, they filmed and edited and composed music for it at the same time. Finally got everything completely finished the first week in June.
Club member and director Jeff Duke says that while he wasn't entirely sure what inspired the series, the club quickly latched on to the idea.
Once they pitched it, everyone in the meeting fell so in love with it that it was like the only idea we thought about, and we realized that it was the concept we wanted to use for our miniseries.
One of the most memorable moments of filming was the dinner party scene, filmed at a crew member's house.
It was the first time in the whole series, in the entire filming process actually, that we had gotten everyone together and that we were all there. It was also the first time that we had really filmed on location, where we had gone somewhere else in order to film a scene. Just having that many people, it was really great.
While Bennett did offer suggestions, and the club members used a formatting program called Final Draft to streamline the writing process, they created the whole script, all 120 pages of it, by themselves. They also handled a great deal of the set design, despite it becoming much more complicated than it had in previous productions.
We used a green screen for the first time. The kids got more into lighting design for the first time. This is the first time we had serious costumes. I'm not really sure what the future holds as far as costumes and sets go. Probably the teens are going to want to do more with sets than they are with costumes.
Perhaps their most impressive work in set design was a time machine prop inspired by Doctor Who. It began with the teens buying a door and some silver and gold spray paint and became steadily more elaborate, gaining cogs, clock keys, and eventually almost an entire clock. Jeff, who also worked on the door, says it was the centerpiece of the series.
It was the time machine. It was how they had gotten back in time. It was just as much a main character as our two protagonists. So we featured it in every episode in some way or another.
Not many teens get to participate in such an undertaking.
When I was younger, I got wrapped up into movies, and ever since then, I've always loved movies. I didn't really plan that this would happen, but I was so glad when I found out that the library had a teen film club that I joined almost immediately.
Right now, club founder Melissa Bennett is introducing members to the various aspects of film production.
I'm trying to, through different workshops that are specifically focused on either directing or camera work or lighting, give them like a more balanced background. For the next project, we call it the Fall Project. We always do a TV series that starts in September and ends at the end of May. My hope is that they can learn better foundational skills in filmmaking and then make more educated decisions about where they want to be placed in the fall.
Bennett also teaches them how to write a script with all the nuances of the medium.
I tell them you have to decide first where is the scene taking place. Is it inside or outside? And then you have to label the scene. Is it in a room? Is it in a forest? And then you have to give a time of day.
Next, you'd set up the scene for the director reading the script, filling in all of the little details, like the age of the characters, or what they're wearing, and pointing out any important items or props in the scene. There's also the matter of directing, which Bennett considers one of the hardest roles.
Directing requires more work. You can't just come in and say, okay, it's my day to direct. The directors really have to look at the script and understand it and be able to know what it is they want to do with the script.
They also have to communicate their vision with the rest of the crew. Bennett says the easiest way to do both is through a storyboard, which is a visual interpretation of the script. On top of that, directors must be able to keep everyone working. While everyone can have their moments, Jeff says he enjoys it all the same.
I love directing. The cast was really cooperative for the most part. It was the first time that I had directed something where we had filmed out of order, so it was definitely an experience trying to make sure that the cast was portraying the right emotions, because we filmed two scenes in the day. One was at the beginning when the two siblings weren't as close as they were by the end of the series, and then we were filming a scene where it was after they had their big bonding moment.
According to Bennett, the club handles this and much of the other work the production process entails mostly by themselves.
They film, they edit, they do rehearsals, they compose their own music. They really do everything themselves. I just help them communicate with one another and sort of set the schedule and organize things for them.
The teenagers meet at the Carteret County Library each Thursday during the summer, and from 9 to 4 on Saturdays during the school year. To see the club's earlier series, From Here to Reality, and working title, Take 3, visit the Carteret County Library. I'm Lee Jenkins.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with ECU Physicians and the East Carolina Heart Institute. Proud to announce the arrival of Dr. Deepa Kabirdas, our newest female cardiologist, specializing in women's health and prevention of heart disease, now accepting patients. The East Carolina Heart Institute, online at ecu.edu/CBS. We'd like to say a big thank you to Lee Jenkins, our intern who's been with us for 4 months. We'd like to wish him best of luck as he returns to his studies at Parrott Academy. This weekend, Craven County Partners in Education will hold their third annual fundraising event, Stuff the Bus, for students who can't afford school supplies. Zanny Owens has more.
Back-to-school shopping has long been a tradition for Americans. Students are given a list of necessary materials to complete the school year. While this preparation for the first day of school can be a source of excitement for some, how do the students whose families can't provide these items manage? Darlene Brown, the executive director of Craven County Partners in Education, has organized a fundraising event aimed at helping students in need.
What we do is we accept donated items that the children need for school. They have identified items that the teachers and principals share with us that the children need, and the children have been identified as in need by their schools.
Stuff the Bus takes place tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. People are invited to literally stuff a bus full of back-to-school items in the Walmart parking lots in Havelock and New Bern.
We put tubs on the buses, and people can buy what they can bring what they buy onto the bus and put it on in the different tubs. And then once we have everything organized, we come back here to the school system and we distribute everything among the buses. We need book bags and things like that, and we take everything and we organize it by grade level, because what they need in elementary school is not necessarily what they need in high school.
Brown states that last year, around 300 students were identified as in need of assistance obtaining school supplies in the Craven County school system. Due to the popularity of the program, Brown expects the number of students to increase.
The word is really getting out among the schools that this program works. And I'm getting more phone calls this year than I think than probably last year, and I would expect that that would easily double, especially considering the trying times that we live in and the parents who are struggling just to make ends meet, and they want to do their very best for their children. And, of course, we want to give every opportunity to the children in Craven County Public Schools to have the best possible items that they can take with them. We want to be sure that they have their pencils and their highlighters and their paper when they start that first day of school, because don't we all remember what that's like?
Craven County Partners in Education, a nonprofit organization, primarily focuses on enhancing resources within the public school system. Last year, the organization gave out $24,000 to Craven County schools to provide materials for students and teachers.
So we have several different grant programs that we have throughout the year to help get money back into the schools for the teachers and the students. And what we do is we are actually the fundraising arm, since we're a 501c3 for Craven County Schools. So we also apply for grants out in the state and nationwide. We received a $10,000 Monsanto grant to build a greenhouse out at West Craven High School. Those are the kind of grants that we apply for.
Also, the organization acquired a $2.4 million science, technology, and math grant aimed towards children whose parents are in the military. Brown says she empathizes with the nomadic lives of military students.
I was raised in a military family, and I understand the importance of helping these kids who have a tendency to move around a lot keep up with what's going on in their schools. And that's, we are targeting those schools that have a high number of military children in their student registry.
Craven County Partners in Education is doing many things to help a variety of students in Craven County. If you're interested in reaching out to students in need, you can participate in the event by donating items tomorrow. Donating on a tax-free weekend helps lessen the cost of donated materials. The donated items will make a direct difference in the educational experience of local students.
Well, it's very fulfilling when you see the kids get their book bags and it's full of items that they were hoping that they were going to get for the beginning school year.
If you'd like to view a list of accepted materials or more information on the event, you can go to www.cravenpie.com. You can also visit www.publicradioeast.org. This is Annie Owens.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. In the last couple of weeks, most of you have heard about the tragedy where children in another country died because food they ate had pesticides in it. This sort of tragedy really can happen anywhere, anytime, if people are not extremely careful with the pesticides in their homes. It's amazing how many people think that just because a pesticide can be purchased at a local store, it must not be toxic. Believe me, many of the pesticides that you purchase can be highly toxic and should be handled with a great deal of care. What are some of the most important basics that you should follow regarding pesticide storage? Well, first of all, never, ever, under any circumstances, remove the label from a pesticide container and reuse that container after it's empty. Ever. It can be triple rinsed and recycled, but it cannot be used for any other purpose. You also never should pour a pesticide from its original container into another container. Many a child has died because pesticides that someone wanted to share from one garden or field to another was poured into an empty soft drink bottle, but the child who picked it up didn't realize what was in the bottle. Don't pour pesticides into other containers for any reason. And what about pesticides that you're storing from year to year? Don't store pesticides anywhere near food of any kind. Don't keep them in the same garage or on shelves near one another. This includes things like ant and roach killer in your kitchen where you have your rice and potatoes, say. Just don't store pesticides near food, ever. And we have something coming up that will help you out if you have some partially used pesticides around your house. You know, of course, to never pour them down a storm drain or into the toilet or down the sink. Those can cause tremendous harm to the environment. But once every 2 years, we have a pesticide collection day here in Carteret County, and pretty much once every 2 years in every county in eastern North Carolina. Here in Carteret, our pesticide collection day this year is on August 14th, and it's going to occur from mid-morning through mid-afternoon right in Moorhead City. You can go to our County Extension website for details. Check with the County Extension office in your county to determine where the pesticide collection site might be. On these pesticide collection days, you can drop off any pesticide, whether it is still legally purchased or not, whether it's partly used or full, as long as it's in an original bottle with a label. You can even get rid of large volumes of pesticide. But we do ask if you have anything over 5 gallons that you call us in advance so that we can arrange for a special pickup on the day before or the day after, or a special time for you to drop them off. But in any event, seeing this tragedy where children died from pesticide poisoning mixed with food, well, it reminds us to get rid of the toxic pesticides that we might have hanging around our house. And since the Cooperative Extension and North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services provides these pesticide collection days, why not take advantage of it this year? And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
If you have a yard, you've fought them before and never won. Commentator Joan Karras takes on the fight.
Have you ever had one of those days when you said, "Phew, at least not all of my body parts are broken"? That's how I felt this morning after about 90 minutes of weeding and planting all on my knees. They still allow me to kneel and work, although other body parts are threatening to resign. I know I shouldn't complain. We are supposed to age gracefully, smiling as cataracts fog our vision, as once attractive bodies sag into the dumpiness of dowagers, as we give away our tennis rackets. Well, I suspect that growing old with grace is something of a myth. Kneeling in the garden is never going to replace playing tennis, even though I was mediocre. Playing tennis was fun. Weeding is a lousy alternative. Weeds are good for nothing, and they're all over the place. Even so, we try not to use those evil killer sprays on them. Instead, I have tried all manner of ecologically safe remedies to kill weeds. The weeds are grateful beyond belief. High saline sprays, vinegar water, uncoated aspirin dissolved in water, chili powder, on and on. No matter what, the weeds hunker down for a day or two, then rebound, healthier than ever. They must think that these distasteful treatments are fertilizer. I've thought a lot about weeds in the last few years, partly because my North Carolina soil grows them so readily, and partly because the earth seems to be densely populated with weeds masquerading as people. human weeds, good for nothing. They are focused, determined, and everywhere. The word compromise is not in their vocabulary. Like their plant counterparts, these two-legged weeds want the whole garden. For our gardens here in Beaufort, I have recently gotten an herbicide that will eradicate weeds. Now they will die out, at least for a while. Plants whose only goals are to bear fruit or lovely flowers will take over the garden, at least for a while. One way or another, we can manage weedy plants. Successfully managing the human weeds is the tougher question. We are still searching for ways to control those who seem so determined to destroy our gardens.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.